Hey everyone, Jay here from Project Unity with what I think is going to be a very exciting talk with two extremely interesting individuals. The talk is going to be focused primarily around the new academic paper, 57 pages in total, highlighting key issues and areas of interest regarding the UAP issue as it relates to science and national security. The paper includes information and insights from Defense Department insiders and scientists, whilst also utilizing a large cache of declassified materials in order to find answers to a host of questions. Are these mystery craft near-peer adversary platforms or exotic US platforms? What is the technology behind them? What kind of threat do they pose? What are the geostrategic implications? And why are we not being told? Joining us to talk about all of this is the author of the paper, Frank Milburn, a strategic and operational advisor, former intelligence officer, and alumnus of Sandhurst and the London School of Economics. Frank has previously written for the Middle East Economic Survey, the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point, and the Institute for National Security Studies at Tel Aviv University. Accompanying us on this discussion, we also have Bob McGuire. Now, Bob served within the United States intelligence community from 1982 to 2011, before going on to found the Humes Research Center for National Security and Technology at Virginia Tech, which is now the highest funded research center at Virginia Tech. He has since become a prominent name within the UFO community, most notably for his involvement with and support of the machine learning surveillance system known as SkyHub, set up by Steve McDaniel. So in this discussion, we have two seasoned individuals from both the British and American intelligence communities on record to discuss the intricacies of the UAP issue as it relates not only to questions within the scientific community, but also its fundamental presence within the architecture of national security. And so it is with great pleasure that I welcome both Frank Milburn and Bob McGuire onto the channel. How are you both?
Very happy to be with you, Jay.
Hey, great. Thanks, Jay.
Well, it's a pleasure to have both of you on. I would love to kick this off with you, Frank, if that's okay. Before we dive into the paper you've written for the Baser Center, I'd just like you to be able to provide, to the extent to which you're comfortable, some insights regarding your own background so that those listening have a better idea of who you are.
Certainly, Jay. I joined the military sort of very young, age 17. I got picked up for officer training pretty quickly. I then went to university, which the military very kindly sponsored me for, and then went to officer training, and I got picked up there for intelligence work. And that sort of period took me from the late 80s to the late 90s. Since then, I've worked in various roles. I worked in journalism, corporate investigations, oil and gas security, and assisting companies working in fragile states and hostile environments.
And I wasn't aware of the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies until now. And to be honest, that's probably just because this is the first time a UAP-related paper has been published by this organization. Can you just give us an understanding of what the Baser Center is and why you approached them in particular for the publishing of your paper on the Pentagon's UAP task force?
Yes, certainly. Just to make clear to start off with, I'm not actually an affiliated scholar with the Begin Sadat Center. I did a piece for them, a short piece for them on Iran last year, and that's kind of how I developed the relationship with them towards writing this paper. The Begin Sadat Center, it's a sort of small think tank. It's a globally ranked national security and strategic studies think tank, which is directly affiliated with Bar Ilan University in Israel. Bar Ilan is Israel's largest teaching university. I haven't actually been there. This is my research. So they basically have a good sprinkling of academic Israeli and foreign academics. And within the Israeli academics, a lot of them come from military intelligence and other backgrounds. So they, while they do focus a lot on Israeli security and national security issues, they do obviously, they cover the Middle East, they cover the Eastern Mediterranean, and they look at global issues like COVID-19, the US elections, and how it affects Israel's sort of foreign and security policy.
And is this, am I right in saying this is the first time anything to do with UAPs has been published on their center?
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, the director, Ephraim Karsh, he's what you call him, he's a professor emeritus at King's College London of history. He was very, very open-minded about it. I mean, I approached him with a bit of trepidation with the proposal for the article. And he was like, no, no, it's like, you know, start writing it. You know, I want to see it.
Oh, brilliant.
He said, you know, this is very kind of outside what we usually do, but he was interested because I told him the people that I would have in the paper, and because I orientated it towards, you know, national security, you know, kind of war studies, geopolitics, because that's what the center does. So if you want to interest the people, the academics there and the kind of people who read their material, that's really what I needed to do. When it came to publication, there was actually quite a long delay. There was a big flash to bang time between the time that I'd actually, you know, sort of written and then delivered the paper and the time it actually got published. It was over 2 months. And there was a bit of resistance from the editorial board towards publishing it. I don't think it's because they were anti the UAP issue. I think it was just so far outside what they'd done before. But I think it was very courageous of them that they actually went forward and published it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And can you break down what the paper ultimately represents? What drove your decision to go ahead and actually publish this?
Yeah, I think first of all, it kind of represents my journey of learning about, you know, phenomena in general and UAP specifically. I started researching, you know, kind of actually collating information about 3 years ago on UAP, and it kind of took over from my interests in the Middle East. And it also represents, I wanted to kind of really reference, you know, the literature relevant to the paper and to acknowledge some of the most respected scholars and researchers in the field, you know, people like Keith Basterfield and Richard Dolan and others. I was heavily influenced by Richard Dolan in it, you know, his UFOs, the national security state. And I think that comes out in the paper. Also, I was listening to Keith Basterfield on a podcast by Erica Lukes, and I was really impressed because he was talking about the sort of mentoring and development of the new ufologists and how kind of established ufologists right. should do that. And he really inspired me actually to start writing, because he said, you know, find a topic that really interests you, maybe something that other people aren't covering so much, and go ahead and start doing the research for that. So that's really what the paper represents for me. But also on top of that, I think the most important thing is I really wanted to move this whole debate, this whole issue. I wanted to move it into the national security strategic studies academia world, because nobody had done that. You know, people, other academics like, I'm not an academic, but academics like Michael Masters, they've been pushing this forward in their field, you know, very courageously. And, you know, physicists, for example, Jack Sarfati pushing it forward in his field, Eric Davis pushing it forward in his field, obviously. And all that was, was stimuli to me, were an impetus towards making me actually want to write this paper and push it out there.
Well, I think it's fair to say it's a very unique paper in regards to things that have been done before, especially, like you said, within the sector of national security and the type of studies that you yourself are involved in and the basis centers involved in. So it's definitely a unique thing. It got a shout out from Christopher Mellon, which was great to see. And so the plan really for this talk is obviously to have contributions from both of you. And so, Bob, I invite you to voice your opinion whenever you would like to as we go through this paper. But one of the initial questions you pose, Frank, is the lack of involvement, at least in a public manner, regarding the Air Force and the UAPTF, or the UAP Task Force, as you correctly put forward in your paper, when the stated mission of the Air Force is to fly, fight, and win in air, space, and cyberspace. It begs the question as to why they remain so silent on this issue. And I'll put this question to both of you. Is it merely down to a lingering stigma, as put forward in Frank's paper via statements from former Lockheed Skunk Works director Steve Justice, or is it more than just Blue Book stigma that is maintaining the Air Force's silence?
Yeah, I mean, I think Bob will probably have the best ideas on it coming from you know, the American side. But from my side, I'd say there's a number of kind of interlocking factors, kind of stigma with Blue Book. I think the fact that UAP operate with impunity over sensitive sites and US airspace in general, that's the Air Force's job, you know, to protect. That's their mission, their raison d'etre. And they maybe feel like, you know, embarrassed that they haven't been able to do that. And also, I think the Navy, because the Navy is detecting airborne surface and subsurface contacts, which are appearing around their sensitive and nuclear platform. And I think as well, the other issue is that the Navy are increasingly exploiting the aerospace overlap that they have with the USAF, and that there's kind of maybe a battle for funding behind it as well. And maybe, you know, the Navy as well, they're completely preoccupied with what's actually going on, you know, with their aircraft, with their surface fleet, and with their subsurface fleet. So the Navy maybe have had their hands very full with the UAP issue, so they've been driving it forward.
So let me jump in here and say that we know quite a bit of history that has kind of leaked out into the public since during and after World War II, which involved the Army Air Force, which became the United States Air Force. And that is, there have been some odd things that have occurred. The announced crash at Roswell and the subsequent, what everyone appears to believe was a massive cover-up and a full blanket of secrecy and a policy of secrecy and denial was taken up and put forward and maintained for years. What I believe we're seeing now is the breakdown in that steel wall of secrecy. I need a few more snippets and tidbits and actual happenings to fully believe that. But the now recognition that Battelle Memorial Institute and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is the home of the Air Force, have largely been involved with whatever has been going on behind the scenes, seems to be coming out into the open. And the United States Air Force chose to end its public involvement with support from the executive branch when the Condon report was done, and they shut down Project Blue Book based on their desired outcome having been achieved in Condon's official report, which, as anyone who's actually studied it, realized that Condon wrote a summary of what they discovered, and it doesn't match any of the contents. So the Air Force wanted UFOs off their plate. Now we've got a new president, named President Trump. He has started the Space Force. That's interesting for a number of reasons. But so space is going to be largely moved off the U.S. Air Force's plate, and they're going to be concerned principally with terrestrial air forces, not space space work. So one of the things that most people don't know, which I think surprises them, the largest aerospace activity group in the United States of America military is the United States Navy. So they have air, sea, and then they carry the Marines to do landings. So the Navy covers the gamut. And my belief is, given personal relationships and personal activities where I've done work with the Navy, I think it's known now that I've spent time on a submarine and spent time with the 7th Fleet on the USS Blue Ridge and so forth, doing my work. You develop these relationships. And my perception, especially around the USS Teddy Roosevelt incidents, which happened 2014, 2015, the Navy is not happy. So the UAPs that Navy Lieutenant Ryan Graves mentioned, these spherical globes surrounding these cubes that had many near mid-air collisions with the flight crews from the Teddy Roosevelt, and subsequent to their doing the exercise off the east coast of the United States, they were followed into the Middle East by these UAPs. They are not happy. They want to know what these things are doing and what they are about. And I think they're asserting that, look, we're going to protect our personnel and our materials, and we have a job to do, and we can't do it while we're looking over our shoulder at something we cannot even characterize.
Something that was mentioned in my talk actually with you, Bob, and Steve McDaniel regarding Skyhub was the concept of sensor fusion. And Bob, you made it clear that the economy of technology and its growing capabilities within the public sector have allowed for the potentiality of levels of sensor fusion that before now were restricted methods, basically sequestered away for use primarily within, clandestine government programs. And within your paper, Frank, you quote Bob regarding this very idea. Could I get some comments from either one of you about the concept of sensor fusion when it comes to civilian and academic groups utilizing this kind of stuff for the analysis of UAP?
Do you want to kick off with that,
So,
Bob?
I'm happy to, Frank. So, but let me do one thing for one piece of bookkeeping first. Frank and I are friends, and the reason we became friends is both of us were heavily involved with the Richard Dolan Forum, and that's where we began to know each other. So I just want to let people know we knew each other from other places before we came in this talk. So you can have all sorts of sensors that collect all sorts of data around all sorts of events. But what you really want is to find out places where one sensor correlates with another sensor's detection. So you can have a video camera collecting a video, but you want to marry that with inertial management unit and accelerometers and pressure and temperature and pressure waves and vibrations and so forth, so that you have a gamut of electromagnetic, acoustical, gravitational, and other effects of whatever it is you're observing to accompany the video. Because who's not tired of lousy, shaky cell phone videos? So the goal is doing observational science. You want to take all the sensors you can support with the equipment you have and marry the output of all those sensors, and you want to learn through the machine learning techniques what constitutes a detection of an interesting event from each of the sensors, and then that trigger from one or more sensors turns on all the sensors. You record all the data and you store it in the digital cloud for others to look at. So the thing that enables that now is the dramatically increased capabilities and complexities of the systems one can put together with modern technology. And it enables average, everyday people to do this, because the cost of this unbelievable supercomputing and the sensors that heretofore would have been hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars has come down under $1,000 total. Now, we will never match the exquisite sensitivities and capabilities and integration of the United States military and its intelligence community, but we can do enough to show interesting things, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think those are all great points. Bob's obviously an expert on that. What intrigued me were Bob's comments and also Chris Mellon's comments regarding, you know, the stove piping. And I think for me, that was a very clear issue within the American intelligence community. I think, Bob, there are, what, 16 different agencies as members of the intelligence community. But the way that they kind of jealously guard their toys, their sensors, and as I put in the paper, that doesn't bode well for looking at America's adversaries if they're not willing to share that data and fuse it.
As someone who can speak on more behalf of the British intelligence community, and because I obviously have no idea myself, is there actually a major difference that you've noticed in regards to how the British intelligence secret keeping is in relation to the US in regards to stovepiping and special access programs and things like this?
Well, I mean, don't forget, Joe, I've been out a long time. So, and also, I mean, I couldn't comment on specifics anyway. But I think it's because the sort of British intelligence community, the world's a lot smaller. So I think it's a lot easier. I mean, they do have their competition, you know, all agencies and formations, you know, they have their bureaucratic sort of rationale. Mm-hmm. So there'll always be some kind of competition. But I think it's easier for Brit agencies, you know, to share just because it's a much smaller world.
Right.
There's I think 16 different major agencies in the United States. So you know, there's a lot more bureaucratic,
a lot of competition.
Yeah.
One of the pages in your paper is titled "Intent to Deceive," and you include a testimony from one Dr. Bruce Cornett, who purported to have witnessed and filmed a cigar-shaped object that unfolded wings and control surfaces which resembled a black 707, and that this craft was also emitting reverse Doppler and false commercial jet acoustic signatures in a deliberate effort to evade detection. And you also include on this particular slide, which is up on the screen for everyone listening, you also include an image that is titled Prediction of Warp Drive, Reverse Doppler Effect, and cite Jack Sarfati as the source. I'm personally not familiar with this case, this UFO case of Dr. Bruce Cornett. And could you tell us why you included his story in your paper and also explain your connection to Dr. Jack Sarfati?
Yeah, certainly. Dr. Bruce Cornett, I mean, he's a very interesting guy. And he did this 9-year study on unconventional aerial phenomena in the Hudson and Wallkill River Valley of New York. Now, I included the intent to deceive part and the reverse Doppler episode because it fitted really nicely in the paper after, you know, like Bob's section on sensor fusion for detection of UAP. The reverse Doppler is fascinating because it demonstrates obvious intent to be stealthy and deceive humans on the part of the intelligences operating the UAP. So the questions that come from that is, you know, well, why do they want to deceive and to what purpose? I connected to Bruce Cornett, I said, because of his near decade-long investigation. And he's a hugely credible guy to talk to, both as an individual guy and also because he's an experienced oil and gas geologist. Now, I used to work in oil and gas running security, so I've got a pretty good idea about what geologists do. And basically, they're the ones telling the oil and gas companies where to do ground surveys, where to do ground mapping with aircraft, so that the oil and gas companies can find out exactly where the oil and gas deposits are. So if you were going to do like ground surveys in that part of New York State, as Dr. Bruce Cornett was doing, you couldn't have a more experienced and professional guy doing it, an experienced oil and gas geologist. You couldn't find a more qualified guy. And then it was kind of a synchronicity because I didn't realize that Dr. Bruce had been talking to Dr. Jack Sarfati about the reverse Doppler effect. But this all came out and Dr. Bruce said, yes, I've been talking to Jack Sarfati. And then I went back through all the notes and papers that Dr. Jack Sarfati had gave me. And then I realized, that there was this connection between them. And I kind of connected the dots together for the paper. So that was a kind of a synchronicity for me.
Can you just explain for those who might not know what a reverse Doppler effect is?
Bob is probably best placed to answer that question.
A lot of people in the community we're addressing with this talk will be familiar with Miguel Alcubierre's warp drive that
yes.
took the entire community by storm. So the way this drive works is it distorts actual space-time. And Hal Puthoff calls it space-time engineering. And so the way it works can be visualized with a rough analogy as follows. I think everybody listening to this understands how a surfer rides a wave. You hop on top of the surfboard, and the wave rises up behind you and falls away in front of you, and the board is propelled forward. This is nearly perfectly analogous to what happens in the Alcubierre drive for space-time engineering. Is space-time develops anti-gravity in back of you and gravity in front of you by curving space-time, because remember, there's no such thing as gravitational force in Einstein's general theory of relativity. What there is curvature. So gravity in the form we're talking about is space bunches up behind you and falls away in front of you, and you're propelled forward while you're in the bubble that's being manipulated in space-time. To me, this explains all sorts of observations if we can ever prove it's possible. How do these things move through our atmosphere, through our water, etc., and leave no wake, show no trails? So if you're manipulating the actual fabric of the universe, moving through air and space at ridiculous speeds becomes a lot more understandable. And so Sarfati has proposed a collection of really difficult to understand equations describing how the tic tacs work, including the space-time engineering. And I do not claim to be able to completely grok all that Sarfati has done there. And so I continue to struggle with trying to find a complete understanding of his writings. And Frank was good enough to interact with Dr. Safadi, and take papers out and give them to the rest of us for us to try and understand. And I'm still struggling with that.
Can I just add to that, Jay?
Of course.
Yeah, and I didn't fully answer your question. I agree with Bob what he said. I mean, if Bob is struggling with it, then someone with my sort of scientific brain capacity is going to struggle with it even more. I started conversing initially with Dr. Jack on LinkedIn. He's a pretty colorful figure. Basically, what interested me was the fact that, you know, here's another academic who's kind of got courage and vision to break mainstream taboos and to both talk and research and write openly about TQ, and also invite people to review his work on academia.com. And you know, people should go and look at his papers there, anybody interested. So then he invites me to start looking at his papers, and he starts sharing other material with me, which is really interesting. And then he starts, you know, putting me in contact with other people who are kind of all the usual suspects. In terms of his ideas, and I think it comes out in the paper, he clashes regularly with Eric Davis, and they certainly clash regularly by email. They also do agree sometimes. I think it's as Sarfati said in the paper, you know, Eric and I might not agree on on the physics of Tic Tac and how they operate, but you know, we both agree that they can present a threat. So they do have areas of overlap where they agree. But I think, like any scientist, you know, they've got different ways that they go about it. But you know, the fascination is actually seeing them, you know, debate the whole Tic Tac tech issue.
When it comes to some of the key players as well regarding governmentally sequestered UAP data, you mentioned the National Reconnaissance Office and the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency as well. But a question I'd like to pose to both of you actually is that with the recent publishing of Lieutenant Tim McMillan's article on The Debrief that was titled Fast Movers and Transmedium Vehicles, the Pentagon's Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon Task Force, Tim gives mention to a previously unknown group within the United States intelligence apparatus known as the National Underwater Reconnaissance Office, or NURO for short, the existence of which, much like the NSA at one point in time and likely some other agencies as well, is being completely denied by the United States government. And I'd like to gauge both of your opinions on this. First of all, have either of you come across this agency name before? And secondly, how significant a role do you feel an agency like this would play in the UAP issue, especially now that we're hearing so much talk about USOs and craft entering and exiting the world's oceans?
Bob, do you want to go first?
I am not that familiar with the NURO's current activities. I think anyone who has followed the activities of the U.S. Navy and its allies around the world realizes that we operate a gigantic network of acoustic sensors in the ocean called the SOSUS network. And outside of the existence of that, I do not personally know any of its capabilities, who maintains them, or how it's operated. So I know of SOSUS, I know what its overall intent is, but I have no personal knowledge of its capabilities, current activities, or who manages it.
Anything to add there, Frank?
I do. I would say, yeah, NURO makes absolute sense with regards to UAP. No, I don't know who manages it. I think also, not just, you know, outside of UAP, it's going to make sense with regards to, you know, the newer, more sophisticated Russian and Chinese subs, plus the lovely North Koreans who are, you know, trying to put ballistic missiles on their submarines. And I think another agency that we shouldn't forget is the National Oceanographic and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It sounds fairly innocuous, but I mean, they have got sensor boys, or buoys, as the Americans like to call them. They've got sensor boys, literally, you know, all over the place, all over the Atlantic, all over the world. I visited Plocan, which is in the Spanish Canary Islands, and it's basically a Spanish and EU center. They've got a shoreside base. Then they've got an offshore platform. They manage all kinds of sensor buoys and also remotely operated vehicles that go around all the islands and go around Spain and go out into the North Atlantic, taking measurements and sensor measurements from the ocean. And they've also got a relationship with NOAA, and they've actually got NOAA buoys there as well. So that's another agency maybe that we should take into account.
That's a really good point. What do you guys think is going on with the oceans? I mean, you know, right now it's kind of the peak of the discussion is things are coming in and out of the water. And, you know, a lot of people are starting to speculate as to whether or not these craft and whatever's operating them even originate from space. Perhaps they actually originate from our oceans as a crypto terrestrial that we're only just becoming aware of. But I mean, what do you guys think about the ocean connection? Is it just a good hideout spot or is there something else going on?
There is no doubt one of the best places to hide on Earth is at the bottom of the ocean. And there's a reason the United States operates the world's largest submarine force and calls it the Silent Service. It's easy to move around and go largely undetected. I think the Navy is particularly concerned that the earlier multi-sensor fusion, modern technology that I spoke of will also render the Silent Service vulnerable. So I just think, you know, they're doing everything they can to protect those capabilities for as long as they can. And USOs and the attention they attract are considered a problem for the Navy because of its desire to maintain this sensor network all around the world, because it contains all sorts of things. I just spoke of one that everybody knows about. I don't really want to comment on any of the others because I don't have personal knowledge of them, but I have a good imagination. I can figure out what other kinds of sensors they would have. But the kind of microphones that hear things, each of us in this field has heard about the large, unbelievable sounds and the things moving through the water at ridiculous, impossible speeds, given that water is an incompressible fluid. We know about these things. I just think the Navy wants to protect those capabilities as long as it can, because the thing that distinguishes our Navy from all others is no one can maintain situational awareness of what's going on in the oceans like the United States can. No one else is even in the ballpark. And they want to protect that.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I would add, I think a lot more needs to be looked at. Russian experience with USOs.
Mm-hmm.
There are, you know, there's literature out there. And I think that needs to be examined a lot more. And then maybe that'll help understanding the Russian experience will help understand what's going on now. I think that the researcher, is it Paul Stonehill? He's written a book on it. Which I've actually got and I want to go through and have a look at.
You also mentioned the Department of Energy, which originated from, of course, the Atomic Energy Commission, formed not too long before the July 1947 Roswell incident. Do either of you feel that the DOE is somewhat of a key holder agency for the UAP portfolio?
Well, there's that fascinating comment from Davis, which is kind of like tucked away from Dr. Eric, when he says in the paper, yeah, I have no UFO propulsion physics projects to be funded. And then he goes, actual research falls under the purview of the military service labs and the DOE labs. Your mm-hmm. UFO propulsion idea, that's Jack Sapati's UFO propulsion idea, will have to stand up to scrutiny by the defense science, military service labs and DOE labs review boards stroke panels. So that's interesting.
Well, let me add, we mentioned the Battelle Memorial Institute earlier and their proximity to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and the Pentacle Memorandum that Jacques Vallée mentions in Forbidden Science Number 1, which ties Battelle into this area. A lot of people don't know that Battelle operates for the Department of Energy many of our national labs, including some of the most interesting ones. So Battelle is the thing that ties both the military and the DOE national labs to this problem, especially if one believes the content of the Pinnacle Memorandum as discovered accidentally by Jacques Vallée and talked about in Forbidden Science Volume 1, and all of the subsequent writings about the Pinnacle Memorandum and Battelle Memorial Institute and this field. It just seems this is an interesting area for those who are doing research and inquiry, and I believe quite a few people are.
Absolutely. Now, you also quoted in the paper, Frank, Senator Marco Rubio, when he made a statement on CNN in July of this year. Now, his statement was, the bottom line is that if there are things flying over your military bases and you don't know what they are because they're not yours and they exhibit potentially technologies that you don't have at your own disposal, that to me personally is a national security risk and one that we should be looking into. If it's something from outside this planet, that might actually be better than the fact that we've seen some technological leap on behalf of the Chinese or the Russians or some other adversary. Our perspective is there is someone flying in the airspace and no one else is allowed to fly in, and we don't know who it is, and it isn't something we have. We need to know what it is. Do you both feel that the level of compounding pressure to open the books on this subject that is beginning to come from such key areas within US government bureaucracy, such as the Senate Intelligence Committee, is it only a matter of time before all the currently classified information on UAPs that doesn't compromise sources and methods is laid out on the table? So anything that is not directly associated with sensitive sources and methods, do you feel that soon this is likely to be laid out on the table?
I would not hold my breath on release of classified data in general. I would say, this is just my humble opinion, it's not just a matter of sources and methods and platforms, but it's also the time taken to produce reports. Now, the UAPTF, they've got to produce a report to the Senate, and we all, I think, know that the juicy bits are going to be classified anyway. Why would you want to waste more time putting out reporting to the public? I mean, they exist to report on threats, and they exist to, they're, when they're summoned by the Senate to report something, then they're going to have to do that. I don't think the UAPTF is going to want to be a kind of a public clearinghouse for information to interested ufologists. That's just my take.
So I want to support Frank's contention and amplify it a bit. So I, of course, am something of an activist on this, so just let me preface my remarks by saying that. I believe that it is hard to continue to justify when technology all over the world is revealing the existence of these strange things happening. It's really difficult to maintain a classification of a statement of existence of the phenomenon. So in other words, the United States government could go a long way towards quieting the clamor by just stating there's something happening. We know some things about it. Here's what we're willing to say. And the rest of the things we're unwilling to say are covered by our need to maintain certain aspects of this phenomenon in order to preserve our perception of our needs to protect our national security. I don't see why it would be so difficult to just say they exist and here's some pieces of evidence,
right,
that come from unclassified sensors that show they exist and that they will reveal things that come from declassified or unclassified sensors is already apparent. They released this video from the F-18 Hornet that came out last week, and they released the videos through machinations that have brought all this stuff up to Christopher Mellon from the Nimitz. So given that they now have declassified those videos and they state emphatically that the incidents did occur, and this was accompanied by a statement that this has no known human origin. That was pretty amazing. So it's just a little more along those lines, including unclassified sensor data showing the existence of the phenomenon, seems to me to be possible and even defensible. And I think there are more than one member of Congress that is tired of this constant stonewall denial when their constituents are clamoring for data. That's number one. Number two, the National Defense Authorization Act, in which went through the Senate and contained the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence language authored by Rubio and staff and other members of the committee has not passed. The House version of the National Defense Authorization Act does not contain what I will call the UFO language. So that means since the House version and the Senate version do not agree in a number of important areas, it will not get sent to the president until conference committee has come together between the House and the Senate and agreed on the National Defense Authorization Act language. And it may not include the Rubio parts funding UAPTF. It may or it may not. And then after that is reconciled, let's suppose that language is included in the NDAA. There are parts of the NDAA which the president has objected to and has threatened a veto.
Yep.
So I'm just telling you, legislatively, the NDAA is interesting to this community, but it is not yet the law of the land, and I can't now predict for anyone when or if that language will become law of the land.
Right, so it is most certainly not set in stone then.
So the UAPTF has minor league funding, and the way that works is near the end of every fiscal year, there are programs in the government that have not spent the funds they were allocated. So unfunded requests are put in to take that money from one entity and give it to another. Such a thing is almost surely what happened inside the Pentagon, and it is the current way UAPTF is being funded. I don't know this from personal knowledge, but I understand how the process works. And I believe that they are funded through this mechanism. That mechanism will not last forever. They need to be a line item in the Defense Authorization Act so the Pentagon can be funded to staff up and maintain the UAPTF for it to gain real traction.
Well, you know, I actually do jump into this a little bit later on in my questions, so we'll circle back and recap in a bit more detail. But I kind of get the feeling that TTSA, you know, as well as speaking the language of the bureaucracy and trying to get everything through legitimized political processes, that they're actually, as well as that, trying to get hold of that larger level of funding that is currently being, you know, sequestered away for other programs by addressing the UAP issue in the way that they are, as a national security threat, as something that that basically requires a huge level of funding and academic and scientific and military interest. So would you say that TTSA are trying to actually, you know, get this subject funded quite heavily via their language within the bureaucracy?
TSA is all over the place. They are the people that made the arrangements for all of the classified briefings that I am personally aware of in front of Congress.
In the paper as well, I mean, Chris Mellons stressed a couple of times, if I'm not mistaken, and he did, I quoted him, you know, he said, so long as it's not compromising, obviously, you know, sources, methods, platforms that our, you know, military and intelligence community rely upon. So that's just the only point I was going to make on that.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. And what I was going to bring up next was that you managed to speak with Dr. Lanny Cass, who is a senior fellow at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, a board member of the U.S. Air Force Institute of Technology, as well as a former professor of military strategy at the National War College. She's also served as special assistant to the Chief of Staff, U.S. Air Force, and as senior policy advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff. Now, she gave you her opinion regarding the UAP issue, which was that although she does not discount the idea of an extraterrestrial or non-human origin, that she would sooner credit the phenomenon to human innovation via black programs, citing examples such as the B-12 platform and how little we know about it outside of its specialized program. Now, Frank, you do cover your opinion on this in the paper, but can I get both of you to give your thoughts on this idea that perhaps a foreign adversary has mastered a totally paradigm-shifting technology? And how does this also account for all of the sightings that have happened before we were flying?
Okay, First of all, I mean, the bottom line is I'm not privy to classified, US or, Western Alliance intelligence analysis on, Chinese or Russian or other near peer adversary advances in kind of, tic-tac tech or interest in tic-tac tech or that kind of exotic technology. I'm also not privy to, sensitive counterintelligence investigations that would shed light on, how the Chinese and Russians are trying to rip off, Western technology and research into tic-tac tech. I think a point just to add to that is the sheer volume of Chinese spying efforts plus Russian spying efforts mean that, Western counterintelligence agencies may not even be aware of all the espionage attempts because there's simply so many. I think that we should confidently assume that Chinese and Russians are extremely interested in tic-tac tech, the reasons that I gave in my paper, craft platforms with these observables, plus, as Chris Mellors pointed out, a total battlefield dominance and battle space awareness. The problem with the terrestrial solution for these platforms is the Chinese, they've reverse engineered and then sold a lot of knocked off Russian air platforms, conventional aircraft. But the Chinese still have problems with their own fifth generation fighters, as I think I pointed out in the paper. For example, their domestic engines are still inferior to Russian ones, so their fifth generation jets are kind of like underpowered and don't work as well as they should. So my contention, and I think that came across in the papers, that if the Chinese did have, tic-tac tech, then one would have expected them to sort out their conventional jet engines by now. But at the same time, I would have to say, never underestimate your adversaries. The Chinese are making considerable advances in other areas of technology, quantum computing. I think they've just announced, that they've got quantum dominance or quantum superiority. But, I'd hand that over to Bob because he's probably got a better idea.
So let me make several different comments. First of all, they do claim that they have achieved quantum supremacy and they wrote a quantum computer algorithm that solved a problem using their version of quantum computer to do what would have taken a million years in a few hours. This is the promise of quantum computing.
Can you just explain China what quantum claims, supremacy is? Sorry, Bob. I just wanted to...
Sure,
sure.
I'm very sorry. Yes, well, quantum supremacy means exactly what I said. Solving a problem in a few minutes that with conventional computers would take so much time you wouldn't even attempt it. So many people know what the traveling salesman problem is. This is the find the optimal path for to move around amongst a group of cities. And then now imagine trying to manage the entire Amazon fleet of vehicles using the traveling salesman problem. It can't be done. So it's done now by approximations. And it achieves some version of optimality. But a quantum computer could solve this problem almost completely. And I have actually worked on and have colleagues at Virginia Tech who've worked on doing the traveling salesman problem on quantum computers with a result. So quantum computers will solve certain kinds of problems much faster than classical computers. And the speed with which they can solve these problems is so much greater. It goes from impossible, impractical, to not only possible, but practical. So that's the promise of quantum computing. Okay, so on the Chinese, they are determined to end the United States naval and other armed forces involvement all over the world's oceans that we guaranteed to the world at the end of World War II in the Bretton Woods agreements. They want us off the Asian continental shelf, and in a government action by the Chinese government, they claimed that the entire Asian continent, continental shelf under the Pacific Ocean and the China Sea, was their territory and we were to get off it. So they want to take Taiwan back so badly, given and there have been some really boisterous statements made by military leadership inside China that have not been played loudly in Western media. So my view of it is, if China had this tech, they would have already gone after Taiwan and run the United States Navy off the South China Sea and probably done everything they could to remove the 7th Fleet from Yokosuka in Japan. I just don't believe they have it or they would have used it. The Russians, they're in a bigger quandary. They've fallen very far behind in a number of areas due to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And for a period of about a decade, they nearly completely discarded their nuclear navy. This appears to me to be resuscitated, and they're taking provocative actions like showing up near our area of responsibility off our coasts in the United States. So the Russians are being very provocative. They're invading the eastern Ukraine and doing some other things. And again, if they had this capability, their desire to end the United States near impossible to overcome supremacy, they would end it by showing that they could do it. Now, maybe there are things about, let's just take an example, this tic-tac technology that we are unaware of because we don't know how it works. So let's suppose the United States government, the Chinese government, and the Russian government all know about the tic-tac and they know how it works. We have some hints that what I'm about to say could be likely. Ben Rich made a comment that was something like, we have the technology to take ET home, but we can't figure out exactly what to do with it. And what do I mean by that? I think that if the governments of the world that have the national capabilities to produce something like Tic Tac, if they knew how the equations work, they may find it impractical. It may take extremely rare things that are extremely expensive to produce to make the Tic Tac work. So maybe you can do it, but you can't do it practically. So it's not practical to depend on it for your military capabilities. I think there's a large collection of arguments that one can make to say the Chinese are not about to deploy it, the Russians are not about to deploy it, and the United States hasn't deployed it to show the others they can't stand up to us. Or likely they would have. So what do I believe? I don't believe we actually have a capable force that can project military power on the planet Earth using tic-tac-like or UFO technology, or we would have. Now, that's my opinion. And when I saw this photo that Tim McMillan published, I had been aware of a position paper being moved around the United States government before I retired and gave up access this last May, that one of the possible conclusions was adversary and extraterrestrial or some other unknown. So we don't know what this stuff comes from. And if the United States government had it, they wouldn't be putting a position paper around that says we don't have a clue and it might even be ET.
Right, right.
Could I just add to that quickly?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, I was going to say, I completely agree with Bob's analysis. The Chinese, you know, they would have rolled over Taiwan. They'd be able to affect a total sort of area denial to any American and allied, you know, warships and aircraft operating in the South China Sea and elsewhere. You know, China's also, you know, been significantly in confrontation with India since, you know, at least 1962. And more recently, they would have rolled over the Indians in the last few weeks and months if they had this technology. If you look at how the Russians have had to prioritize their defense spending, like in the last, you know, decade, they've prioritized, okay, some new missiles, hypersonic missiles. They've been developing some new nukes, some new subs, but they've had to very much prioritize. And you can see this in Syria. Yeah. They prioritized like electronic warfare. They prioritized expeditionary forces like their desant, their airborne, their marines, their ability to project limited amounts of power in limited parts of the world. I'm sure if they had this technology, they would have reclaimed the former Soviet Union by now.
Right.
And also, the Americans have been in, and their allies, they've been in war in, Afghanistan, Iraq for the best part of 2 decades. Imagine all these supplies have to, travel across the mountains of Pakistan into Afghanistan. If you had the technology, instead of like risking guys and their lives and supplies going by roads, which are, highly, highly dangerous. If you had the technology, you'd build huge triangular craft that could just appear in space and time at the right place and deliver the supplies without any risk. Yeah, so great analysis on that, Bob, on the sort of Chinese and Russian capabilities. I mean, they've definitely got the intent, but have they got the capability? I don't think so.
They would have acted. You know this, Frank. You've been in this a long time, both in intel and military, and I've been more intel than military, but I have also done military, and we both know if they could act, they would. And Russia, let's just take Russia. They showed they would by attacking Ukraine to get a warm water port.
Yeah.
Even as sorry as that warm water port is, because they got to go through the Straits of Isthmus. So it's just, it makes no sense. They don't have the tech or they would use it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, they wouldn't have to be relying so much on, kind of like semi-alliances with people like Iran, either the Russians. They'd just be able to completely do their own thing if they had this technology. I think
the United States just recently fired a warning shot across their bow because of their development of all these hypersonic missiles. And you notice the United States hasn't done a total huge amount of work on developing these hypersonic missiles. And you wonder why, given that the other people are doing it. Well, the Navy just recently announced that it was deploying its lethal at hundreds of miles directed energy beams. It'll knock these hypersonic missiles right out of the air.
I really hope so.
I'm back, gentlemen. Sorry about that. Right. How are you guys doing for time? Because we've still got quite a few questions to go through.
Much as you need.
Go through it all.
Fantastic.
As much as you need.
That is what I wanted to hear. So you also mentioned the 5 observables, which are the observed capabilities and characteristics of UAPs. The term the 5 observables was given to us by former ATIP director Luis Elizondo, and this has since become the 6 observables, with biological or human effects being added to the list, which involves the changes that occur on a biological level with humans who interact with or are in close proximity to UAPs. And this has also been categorized as field effects on biological tissue, which was a similar name was given to the title of one of the Defense Intelligence Reference Documents contracted via the ATIP program, which was released alongside 37 other extremely novel studies involving various breakthrough technologies and physics concepts that were essentially extrapolated from the observed data of UAPs. I also felt personally that the 5 or 6 observables may be an oversimplification that is intended more for civilian digestion rather than academic specificity. So do you guys think that there are more observables than just the 6? And are you of the opinion that these observables are the results of multiple different technologies or merely a singular technology that has a spectrum of effects?
Bob, do you want to kick off with that and then I'll add anything else?
Sure. So I believe this collection of observables were written down so that the technology using people in the intelligence community and the military and the scientists and technologists that back them up could brief people above them who are policymakers who couldn't understand one thing that's on this slide if they had to. So in other words, this is like a briefing slide you would present to those who are being talked into funding your efforts. That's number one. This was not intended for the public. It just is a byproduct of the revealing of ATIP, Nimitz, Teddy Roosevelt, etc., that they would use the same language they're being used to sell the ATIP mission to the funding and policy people in the government to tell the story of what went on to the public. In other words, they lifted this from what they were selling inside to informing people outside.
Okay. I would add to that, Keith Basterfield on his blog, he mentions an article by Danny Silver. So it's worth having a look at Danny Silver's page as well. He's talking about the six observable. So he's talking about like motor vehicles and the effect on terrestrial technology, I suppose you call it, motor vehicles, aircraft. Also, another interesting coverage of that is if you go back to the Project Condyne report that I mentioned in my paper, which is the full title was Unexplained Aerial Phenomena in the UK Air Defence Region, which was this Defence Intelligence 55 report that was sort of finalised 1999, 2000. And that goes into at length. It talks about physiological issue, effects on humans. It talks about effects on RF radiation. It talks about I think some effects on tissues, and it also talks about effects on aircraft and vehicles. So that's well worth a look at too.
Yeah, we're going to jump into that a little bit further down the line with the British involvement, and with other papers that you've quoted. You also quoted a paper titled "Estimating Flight Characteristics of Anomalous Unidentified Aerial Vehicles," which is a paper I would recommend everyone listening to check out. And this paper is linked in the description box of this video. It's actually been linked to most of the videos that I've done for quite some time, actually. And you included a quote which mentions how some of the estimated acceleration ranges of UAP can go from 100 G to excess of thousands of G's with no observed air disturbance, no sonic booms, no evidence of excessive heat commensurate with even minimal estimated energies. We also know that these objects can seemingly enter and exit the water at high speeds with zero displacement or disturbance of the water. And, you know, as a layman to physics and quantum mechanics, this to me can only be possible if the craft itself is essentially in a bubble, like the craft must be contained within some form of ambient energy field that sits in what I would imagine to be a comfortable 1G environment at all times. In other words, the craft's energy application places a buffer between the craft and the localized area of space-time that it appears to inhabit. And I don't know, it just seems like the craft exists, but it's separated from all of the environmental, physical, chemical stimuli of its surroundings. So I don't know if either of you want to comment on that.
Yeah, so we talked about Miguel Alcubierre's space-time engineering metric drive before, and what you're saying is completely consistent to the extent we understand it at all with that very thing. So it produces propulsion and moves the vehicle by actually manipulating the universe around it. So it is flowing through the universe, but not really completely connected to the rest of the universe while it's moving. That's the first thing I want to comment on. And it never ceases to amaze me how much people don't look back in time to see what others may have done before them. So I'm going to do here what I do everywhere, every time this comes up. In 1969, Major Donald Kehoe and Gordon Lohr, who ran the NICAP, wrote with the chief researcher and writer for this thing being Gordon Lohr, wrote a paper, a monograph, called The Strange Effects from UFOs. And it's copyright 1969. So it's not like we don't know these things that ATIP pointed out. We've known about them for a long time. The thing that ATIP, TTSA, and others did for us was make it part of the common conversation and lexicon and make it accessible and presentable and not look like you're a stupid moron believing the craziness, and it's showing up on mainstream media. But the kinds of things that ATIP pointed out have been known since at least the early 60s.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with all of that. I included, from Professor Hill, the old school kind of like UFO weapons theories, to link that in, Also, John Alexander with his theoretical physics group, you know, he's talking about, you know, the similar, you know, similar kinds of characteristics. So, yes, I totally agree with Bob. I mean, this has been talked about and written about from the 1960s.
I think Frank and I both know that the reason progress has not been made on understanding things about the propulsion methods, et cetera, of whatever this thing is, whatever it is, it moves from point A to point B by some means. Scientific inquiry leading to engineering possibilities and then practical application and the engineering solution are best done in the wide open.
Yeah.
The secrecy is in the way of making real progress on this. So so secrecy is a problem. And even the people that are maintaining the secret know this. It's not possible to find the 10 perfect people that you bring in and tell the secrets to and have them solve all the problems. Scientific inquiry is where you put out for the public all that you know and let every mind on the planet look at it. And of course, the counter argument to doing that is, but our adversaries might learn how it works before we do, and then they will overcome us in a handful of minutes once they understand it. I understand the argument. I'm just telling you what the problem is, because we can identify writings all the way back into the 60s that show that people understood what was being observed, but there's no explanation that's become forth that is credible, that will produce the actual results we're seeing, because it's not open to the typical scientific methods for inquiry. And even Alcubierre's drive, which seems so attractive because it really does come really close to explaining the phenomenon we see, including the transmedium movement from air to water, and then the jumping from one place to another with apparent no motion. It explains it. The problem is Alcubierre's solution requires unobtainium, this unobtainable negative mass and negative energy that one needs to engineer it. So there's something about manipulation of space-time that we just don't understand. But we see these observables. What my hope is we can get to a point where the stuff is discussed more openly.
Do you ever get the idea that it's actually maybe a lot simpler than people think it is? Because I can't remember who it was, but I believe it was a Lockheed director that was once quoted to say that there's a problem in the equations, but we solve that equation or we solve that issue. And it makes me wonder if, you know, we feel like it must be such a complex, I mean, obviously in terms of science, it is complex, but because of the capabilities being shown by these things, we must assume it's, you know, thousands of years ahead of what we're capable of doing. But do you ever get the idea that perhaps it's literally just one discovery around the corner?
So I quoted Ben Rich earlier, and he's the person that said that. He was the head of Skunk Works for a long time, and he is quoted as saying those things, both what you said and what I said, by Jan Harzan.
Now, you include a good level of information regarding Dr. Eric W. Davis in your paper, Frank, as well, with good reason, of course, because as you say in the paper, some of the most incredible revelations to come from a current Pentagon insider who has been involved in phenomenology research for the best part of a quarter century is Dr. Eric W. Davis. And in your paper, you include emails that you had seen that reveal what you called startling revelations about the UAPTF. As a disclaimer, I must add that all of the emails in this study were reprinted with permission. The email thread in question is between Eric Davis and a man named Sid. I don't know if you can give me more background on him. And it's a back and forth regarding the Nimitz videos and the subsequent briefings that Eric Davis had provided for US officials. One key point to highlight is Eric Davis's statements regarding how he was made a deputized advisor under the Department of Defense for the investigator of both the Nimitz and Roosevelt UAP incidents, that he was hired basically under a subcontract for the DOD. What, in your opinion, are some of the most relevant comments made by Eric Davis in this email chain that you have revealed?
Sure, Jay. First of all, yeah, it wasn't a private conversation between Dr. Davis and this guy, Sid. it was on a kind of like an informal email sort of forum chain of, I don't know, maybe three, maybe even four dozen people, with, I think I alluded to, all the usual kind of suspects, physicists, you know, Jack Sarfati, Eric Davis, you know, people from sort of like, you know, media, the media world, Chris Mellon, Lou Elizondo, you know, they were copied in, Dr. Puthoff was copied in. But the going from the sort of top with that, what I found was really interesting, yes, was that comment about being a deputized advisor to the Nimitz and Roosevelt investigators. So right there, it's like, okay, so you've got two different investigations. Who was this investigator or who were these investigators? And as I asked in the paper, so if we're talking about the Nimitz investigation, so this is taking us to pre-ATIP days, so it's from pre-2007. So if it is pre-2007, then what was the name of that program pre-ATIP and which part of DOD was running it? Was it Navy or Air Force? Was it DIA? The other interesting question that I have from that is what's been coming out with some of the witnesses, the Navy witnesses from Nimitz, which was U.S. Air Force officers taking custody of hard drives from Nimitz group ships and also aircraft. And the question I asked was then, was Dr. Davis privy to a 2004 pre-ATIP Air Force investigation potentially? Other comments which are very interesting are about the videos not being hoaxed, that is the U.S. Navy videos of UAP. So he's confirming, right, they're not hoaxed. Then goes without saying his off-world comments and saying this is where the physics and the facts lead, that these craft are off-world. And then there's the interesting comments about ORSAP and saying that basically he and Dr. Puthoff, that they weren't tasked to explain tic-tac or UAP propulsion or power physics, but they were trying to extrapolate forward these engineering physics requirements across the range of topics that the 38 defense intelligence reference documents covered, that they wanted to cover these 38 different topics the year 2050 to determine whether engineering physics could approach or approximate the capabilities and characteristics of Tic Tacs. And the way that he states this is in a scenario where Tic Tacs or UAP could become a future threat to the United States. So, I mean, that's absolutely fascinating right there. It also kind of correlates with his comments to Alejandro Rojas in the interview from last year about, if Tic Tacs, present themselves as a threat, if they want to be a threat, then they could be. So that's absolutely fascinating. It's also, go on.
No, please.
I was going to say, it's also fascinating when he's talking about, you need to have a craft in your lab to examine it and measure it. And you can't just speculate or hypothesize, in the absence of, having access to that craft. And the way he says, data shouldn't be limited to the FLIR videos from the F-18, from surface warship radars and sensors or pilot reports. And then, as we've already covered, he talks about, the Department of Energy labs, review boards and panels. Now this goes back as well to a point that we already covered when he's saying, and on the flip side of that, boy, would it be wonderful if we could get there, because commercially it would revolutionize transportation and energy on the earth. Now that actually came from the Alejandro Rojas, but I thought that's fascinating because he's basically essentially saying there, boy, if we could get there, that means it, to my view, it means he's saying that we don't have it yet.
Well, that's actually leads a little bit into something I wanted to ask, because what are your thoughts on Eric's supposed meeting with Admiral Thomas R. Wilson and the subsequent leaking of the meeting's transcript that's known as the Eric Davis notes or the Wilson documents? Do you think these notes represent a legitimate scenario, personally?
As I alluded to in the paper, I keep an open mind. I said that my opinion on that, on keeping an open mind, depended very much on the research, one of the principal researchers involved, R. Dolan, because I respect his work very, very much. Unfortunately, he can't produce, for source protection reasons, the kind of source that he was discussing. What really sold it on me as well were, you know, Bob's comments about, you know, the letter that he'd seen, and obviously Bob can't go into more detail about that. So those made me really keep an open mind. So I would say, yes, it does represent a legitimate scenario. I think more work needs to be done on it. But, you know, it's been absolutely fascinating what's been done so far on that. So I'm keeping an open mind. What I would say, though, is, you know, I would like to see some firm proof on that. And that, yeah. And anonymous experts and anonymous insiders, they don't constitute proof.
Anything to add there, Bob?
I completely agree with that. Me seeing something is not proof of anything. It just is an interesting data point that goes nowhere. The other thing I want to emphasize, given the content of the last few minutes, are things that I feel are being missed by our community altogether and were not available when Frank wrote this paper. So the Fox movie phenomenon has come out, and in it were revelations that are,
yes,
to me, as important as any actual incident discussed in the movie. And let me go over those in detail. So in the show Unidentified, Christopher Mellon says, these things are not from here. We don't know where they are. The Nimitz stuff was not U.S. tech. So you go, okay, that's interesting. Coming from the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence, that means something. It went even further in the movie phenomenon. Christopher Mellon stated openly that he sat on the committee that runs all special access programs for the Pentagon. That means there was nothing going on in the Pentagon that Christopher Mellon was unaware of. Period. End of story. These things that we saw around the Roosevelt and around the Nimitz were not secret Pentagon programs, or Christopher Mellon is a liar.
Do you think that there's ever, I mean, obviously, like you said, he was in total oversight, but we do obviously talk about the bifurcation between potentially the contract to private industry world and the government oversight. And do you think that there's any potentiality for him to not be aware of maybe some very dark, deep secret contractor, private, totally separate from government work?
Yes. Then the reason I say yes is what we've already discussed. Mellon was intelligence and defense, and Battelle runs DOE labs, and the top secret and super secret classification levels, classification credentials inside the Department of Energy are roughly the equivalent to secret and top secret, are L and Q. And that is a separate classification system for that maintained by the executive branch and the military, which is top secret, secret, and it's confidential and unclassified for official use only and unclassified. Those are separate systems. And they're rough equivalences. And if you're in one and you have business requiring you to have need to know with the other, it's a bureaucratic transfer. That's all it takes for you to go from one to the other. But the facts are, we don't know whether or not Christopher Mellon ever had access to the DOE and the DOE special access stuff. We don't know that. We know he had access to Pentagon and executive. We know that stuff because he was staffer to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence before he became DASDI. So I believe that there are things that Christopher Mellon could not know because he was not in that stovepipe. And we've talked about what these stovepipes produce all along. So DOE stovepipes, I don't know, and we have not been told whether or not he ever had access to it.
Well, I think even he acknowledges that. Yeah, please, go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, I was going to actually, yeah, just support what you're saying, Jay. And I agree totally with what Bob's just said. And if you go back to, you know, what Eric Davis was telling Alejandro Rojas, you can see quite clearly he's talking about the stovepiping. He talks about, you know, the difficulty for scientific inquiry. You can't just go and ask anybody if you have a, you know, if you run into a brick wall on the science and the investigation about the compartmentalization, how left hand doesn't talk to the right hand. So yeah, very clearly he might not have had access to everything. And that's the thing that would be interesting to know. But I mean, I know from, I mean, my own background, my own experience, I mean, compartmentalization is everything. If you're not involved in something, you're not involved in something because you don't need to be involved in something. Or somebody thinks that you don't need to be involved in something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So moving on to...
The other thing I want to add before we go on is scientific inquiry is primarily asking the right question. So my own personal experience gives me examples of this in practical terms. So during my tenure working for the intelligence community as a person that did technical development, I saw and I did things that were useful to the United States government and its jobs. And the reason I did them is because I was asked the right question about things that needed doing. So if you're never asked the question, you have to dream it up on your own. So I would regularly do things that would take years before they were produced in the outside world. And I saw this happen many times. And it's covered up with classification, and you can't talk about it. You can't even confirm that you did it after it becomes known outside. So this statement is right on the money. Scientific inquiry is not aided by secrecy.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. Now, one of the pages on the paper is titled Voodoo Warriors, and you mentioned the formation of the Advanced Theoretical Physics Group, which was nicknamed by the Washington Post as the Voodoo Warriors of the Pentagon. Can either of you brief me and the listeners on the Advanced Theoretical Physics Group? Because I have heard of it, but I'll be honest and raise my hand and say I haven't done too much background.
Yes, it was a group that was formed by Colonel John Alexander in the Pentagon, and he said it was so named so that it would avoid kind of freedom of information requests about UFOs. And if I sort of quote him directly, it says or paraphrase him, it allowed him to function within acceptable limits while simultaneously pushing the boundaries of traditional credibility. So he said also as well, it was difficult finding the right network of people to join it because sort of the phenomena in general and UFOs were not seen as career enhancing.
Yeah.
So he gets, an initially informal group of people together. So he says membership includes people from Army, Navy, and Air Force. Plus he gets aerospace and defense people in, as well as the intelligence community. So he said there was at least one representative from Lockheed's Skunk Works. And so they were basically involving military cases where weapon systems that could pose a significant threat and should be investigated. And, you know, he goes on to describe in his book, which is well worth a read, Colonel Alexander goes on to describe, you know, the kind of observables, what they were finding, you know, the very fast, sharp turns, 90 degrees, the G-forces that humans couldn't, tolerate and live, what we discussed previously in the presentation.
I want to support what Frank has said there completely. And Lou Elizondo described Dr. Colonel Alexander as that person who has been involved with all the weird stuff in and around the Pentagon for his entire career. And I can testify from my own personal knowledge, he is a legend.
Yeah.
He is absolutely a legend. So all this kind of woo stuff all of us have heard about from the remote viewing work out at Stanford Research Labs and all the way through non-lethal weapons, trying to figure out stuff around the propulsion technologies around this phenomenon, you will always find John Alexander was involved.
Mm-hmm.
So I strongly recommend that people read the books that John Alexander has written, and to get a little more insight, I interviewed Alexander for Spaced Out Radio 2 months ago, and that's available on YouTube.
Yes, I would encourage people to check that out.
If I could just mention on that, I mean, Colonel John Alexander, I have to say a big shout out to him because, like Dr. Sarfati, he gave me a hell of a lot of access and a hell of a lot of his time. He actually suggested to me, call me and, let's nail down these things. I mean, he gave so much of his time back and forth with emails, talking. So I really appreciate that. And in person, he's incredibly, incredibly, knowledgeable, but also incredibly humble as well. When you actually meet him, because he's got this big myth about him, but he's a really, really fantastic and down-to-earth guy to talk to.
In your paper, you also mention Luis Elizondo's statements in June 2019, when he admitted on record that the US government has debris from a UFO in its possession. And you go on to include Eric Davis's statements that were published in July via the New York Times, wherein he claims to have given classified briefings to a defense DOD agency as recently as March of this year regarding retrievals of, and I am now quoting, off-world vehicles not made on this earth. Now, personally, my first thought with that quote is the Eric Davis notes regarding his meeting with Admiral Wilson. The language used here is extremely similar in regards to the statement off-world vehicles not made on this earth. It is pretty much verbatim. Do you think Eric Davis worded that quote the way he did in order to acknowledge the Admiral Wilson documents in a nuanced manner, or is it just coincidence?
I can't speak for him. And I don't like to speculate as to what he did or did not intend with that quote. I think that it's basically just not coincidental, but it's sort of like a synchronicity, and it comes out what Elizondo has said, what Eric Davis has said, both in the to Alejandro Rojas, what he's written in emails. So yes, I mean, quite possibly it could be connected. I don't know if he's deliberately quoted it that way or not.
I want to ditto what Frank said. I just don't think we can figure that out. So I want to also mention that Luis Elizondo went on Tucker Carlson and said, we have crash debris.
We've actually spoken about the Alejandro Rojas interview with Eric Davis, but I did want to bring this up as well, because, as you said, Eric Davis interview with Alejandro Rojas is included in your paper, which is such an important interview because Eric is speaking so candidly about crash retrieval programs. But it does, at least for me, it makes me wonder how he is able to do so with such confidence. Does it not run the risk of affecting his standing within the UN, within the intelligence and contractor community? Do you feel that, I don't know, do you both feel that Eric Davis was being honest in this interview with Alejandro when he speaks about how superpowers of the earth have all had crashes, that they have all recovered vehicles from these crashes, but also that the crash retrieval programs are underfunded and do not make up a large section of government infrastructure? Do you think that we can trust everything Eric is saying in this interview?
Bob, do you want to go first on that?
I have zero belief that Eric Davis is a liar. I just don't believe it. The guy took an incredibly promising theoretical physics degree and profession after he graduated from university in Arizona. And for one reason or another, purely personal experience, like many of us, changed his direction and made himself a pariah in some ways in the academic physics community by engaging in these topics. I just don't believe he has a reason to lie. I can't think of any reason that would cause him to want to lie. So that's just my personal opinion. I don't know Eric that well. He and I have interacted a little bit, but not very much. And he has not lost his security clearance. He's currently working for one of the premier federally funded research and development centers in all of the United States, support of all the United States government, in the Aerospace Corporation. The Aerospace Corporation is the United States Air Force, National Reconnaissance Office, et cetera, think tank. And they maintain the corporate knowledge in aerospace matters for all the United States government, and regularly on behalf of the government hand out those materials to corporations to do things on behalf of the United States government. And so they have been accused of being the location of the core secrets. So I have no personal knowledge about that at all, but that's been regularly accused of housing it. And Eric Davis, my last information about where Eric is that he is at the Aerospace Corporation offices at Marshall Space Flight in Huntsville.
Jay, I would just add to that. I agree 100% with Bob on that. I have only interacted with Dr. Davis by email, but as you can see in the paper, John Alexander, who I spoke to at length on numerous occasions, he said, you know, he knows him very well from like NIDS days. They go back, you know, long, long way. If you look at what Dr. Eric Davis has said in the Alejandro Rojas interview, it chimes exactly with the emails that are in the paper. His reputation kind of precedes him. And if you talk to guys like Joe Mergia, who actually knows him personally, if you talk to Colonel John Alexander, you know, he's basically a patriot, a highly intelligent guy, a scholar who's fully immersed in his subject matter. Like Bob, I don't think he's got any reason to lie whatsoever. And his comments about, you know, the sort of inability to exploit this recovered tech, it goes back to, you know, the points that we discussed previously. Well, if you had this game-changing tech, then you know, why hasn't it been used in recent conflicts?
Well, it's a brilliant point to bring up as well. And actually, one thing I'd like to ask both of you is, would either of you consider the UAP issue as a direct threat or merely that it has the potential to pose a threat?
Bob, do you want to go first on that one and I'll follow up?
No. You wrote all that stuff in your paper. You go.
Okay, absolutely. I think that it depends the way that you look at it. Okay, so threat is capability plus intent. But to understand intent, you have to know, what is the intelligence behind, the phenomenon. Yeah, what is the intelligence that is controlling these craft or piloting these craft? And if you don't understand that, then you can't understand whether it's a threat or not. And if you look, for example, people call themselves experiences because they've had positive experiences with phenomena. Other people call themselves abductees because they've had negative experiences with the phenomena. So with the huge variety of craft and occupants of craft seen, that would lead me to kind of conclude that there must be different intelligences out there, different intelligences with different agendas. So therefore, some maybe, have, malign intent and therefore pose a threat. Others don't have malign intent and therefore don't present a threat. But certainly with the technology that they have, they could pose a threat if they wanted to pose a threat, as, Chris Mellon has said, as Elizondo has said, as Dr. Eric Davis has said. So you have to assume a worst case scenario if you're a military person and you're defending your country and you're defending your airspace and your sea space. You have to assume it's a threat until it's proved otherwise to be a threat. That doesn't mean that you have an aggressive posture. Basically, what it means is that you are planning for the worst and hoping for the best.
So I want to support what Frank has said 100%. So I worked for the United States intelligence community and in support of the Department of Defense in various ways and the Department of Energy at times for my entire technical career. And they are tasked with one job, defense of our nation's national security. So their job is to question everything they can to determine whether or not it can pose a threat. And everything the phenomenon is accused of having done says to the intelligence community and the DOD, this poses a potential threat. They overfly our nuclear missile silos in the northern United States and turn a bunch of them off. After the Soviet Union fell, we learned from the former Soviet missile force commanders and the which became the Russian missile commanders that the UFOs overflew Russian missile silos and turned a bunch of them on and gave them launch orders. And they barely managed to shut them down before they were launched. We have whatever the phenomenon is, overflying carrier battle groups. And when approached by airplanes from the carrier battle group that turned on their radar, the objects jammed the radar inside the area, this keep out area of the aircraft carrier battle group. That could have turned into something really bad, because the commander of the battle group is within their immediate reaction rights to take the jamming of the radar of planes they've sent out as an act of war, and are allowed to act aggressively. So stuff could really go wrong based on misunderstanding while these people are doing exactly what they're supposed to do. An unknown technology flies somewhere near them or underneath them in the water or wherever, and acts in a way that is uncoordinated with them and appears to be something like reconnaissance. The only responsible action that the military and the intelligence community can take is to continue to observe and assess whether or not these things pose an actual threat. And this is notwithstanding any of the other things we know about actions that we don't understand why they're claimed to have been doing these things, like the phenomena of abductions. We don't know why they're doing it, and that seems to me awfully hostile. So the only job these entities have on behalf of the government is to protect our national interests, and so they are derelict of their duty if they don't consider all aspects of the phenomenon, including whether or not they are a threat.
Well, one thing that I thought was quite interesting is a conversation between yourself, Frank, and Colonel John Alexander, and that's regarding the nature of TTSA's narrative and the misconception within the UFO community surrounding the concept of a threat. Now, I've always personally been of the opinion that the members of To the Stars Academy, such as Luis Elizondo, Christopher Mellon, Jim Semivan, are using the terminology and policy structure of the US government bureaucracy to essentially play the system by its own rules, forcing official responses from agencies and respective departments via their knowledge of how information flows or gets blocked within the channels of the USG defense intelligence infrastructure. And so the term threat is a key word that can be used to disseminate stovepiped information under the auspices of national security concerns. But what John Alexander brings up in your paper is the fact that this also plays into potentially the funding prerequisites for government programs or studies, and that the threat narrative is also beneficial in streamlining the government funding process for the UAP issue. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree to a certain extent with that. I mean, military structures, military formations, the US military and the UK military, they exist basically to protect their countries and to protect, the Western alliance effectively. So you need to have threat in the context to justify resources, to justify mission, and to justify raison d'etre. But at the same time, if you look at the UK Project Condon report, and this is actually where it's very, very interesting, that the guy's writing the report going, well, UAP are of no defense significance. But at the same time, they're referencing, Russian studies where the Russians are saying, oh, wow, we've lost pilots, and pilots definitely consider UAP a threat. And we've tried to chase and intercept UAP, and, we've lost pilots in the process, and, we're interested in the technology. So you have to ask yourself, well, the Brits, they're looking at, at the time during the Cold War, the major adversarial air force in the world that the Brits and the Americans would have been operating against. So if your adversary is considering this to be a major threat, do you not think that the Brits and the Americans would consider it to be a major threat? And also, if you look at the comments that Dr. Davis made about Colares in Brazil, people being killed, people being hit by rays, that's not demonstrating benign intent. That would be interpreted as being hostile intent, especially if you were the family of somebody who'd been lost. If you look at the Frank Pacino book about, shoot them down, the UFO air wars, the Americans lost aircraft. Maybe the Brits lost aircraft. I don't know. But there's certainly some, cases to suggest that they did. And then if you look at, the work of David Jacobs, if you want to go a bit more kind of down the rabbit hole, there certainly seems to be in his view, at least, on the part of, you know, one particular intelligence, that there is, you know, a malign intent and therefore a threat. So yes, on the one hand, you need to have threat to justify funding, but on the other hand, you have to be prepared to face, you know, potentially real threats.
I support Frank 100%.
Next thing I wanted to kind of dive into is that you quote theoretical physicist Miguel Alcubierre, famous for his Alcubierre warp drive theory, as he explains how the warp drive method does not work against general relativity and does not require the introduction of wormholes in order to be actionable. And you are also, Bob, regarding the propulsion or power method that's potentially involved with UAPs, Bob, you said the following is a and this is actually something that you said beforehand, but I'm going to quote you anyway from the paper. The following is a rough analogy. Your spacecraft is a surfboard. You have a machine that generates waves that travel very fast through the water. The water doesn't move fast, but the waves do. You ride the wave and you go fast. The hard part is making the wave machine work. Now, Dr. Jack Sarfati is also quoted to say that the technology behind the Tic Tac UFO involved in the USS Nimitz encounter of 2004 is not mysterious at all, that it folds space into a warp drive in such a way as to get to where it desires with tiny amounts of energy. Now, Sarfati claims we can build our own Tic Tac platforms quickly and that it would be in America's best interest to do so, as Russia already has a head start, going on to say that such spacecraft would render all of our conventional weapons obsolete, particularly if the so-called warp capacity of this technology were to be weaponized. Now, my question to you both is this: how far away do you believe we are from creating these platforms and being able to generate the energy required in order to match the performance capabilities of the Tic Tac? How far away are we from getting, as Bob said, the wave machine to work?
So I don't understand all of the underlying claims, the basis for the claims in Sarfati's papers. That means that I have to do a lot of work to get there, and I have other things I'm trying to do. So I haven't been able to get there and interact with him, and I just have not had the chance to interact with Jack Sarfati on this. Eric Davis has, and I respect Eric Davis, and I don't think Eric and others that have read Jack's papers agree that, if you'll pardon a euphemism, there's any there. And the scientific community, as it's regularly practiced, has not embraced Sarfati's work. And the reason I say this is it is not published in a peer-reviewed journal, because the people just do not understand. Publishing a scientific paper in a peer-reviewed journal is an adversarial process. You do your best job, you write up your technical work, and you submit it, and then an anonymous board of referees shoots at you with every cannon they've got to try to poke holes, to make you improve your argument. And if you survive that brutal process, then your paper is published and others can read it. And so that's how science works. Jack has not done that. He has not taken his paper and submitted it for peer reviewed and interacted with people. And Frank knows, as I do, and others that were on that email, Jack treats challenges to his statements as personal offense. And so it's hard to interact with Jack to try to understand what he's doing. And I wish that he would just calm down, talk to people, and let us figure out what it is he's trying to tell us. Because the problem with the Alcubierre drive, in the way Miguel and others, including this brilliant Masters of Science student at the University of Alabama at Huntsville, have shown us, is you need unattainable negative energy and negative mass to make it work. And so until all of that is resolved, we're not going to build it. Because right now I can't say, okay, that equation lets me sit down and figure out how to do an engineering project and build something that will do it. So I can't do it because it does not yet make sense. And until we're there, nothing will happen.
I defer to, you know, Bob's, like, you know, far superior, you know, sort of scientific intellect and knowledge on that. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a physicist. I mean, you know, it was tough for me getting through trigonometry to pass my maths exam. I can only go on in terms of, you know, how quickly the technology could develop. I can only go on what I've been told by people who are way smarter than me. Now, to me, there seems to be there's a kind of disconnect between what Dr. Jack says. You know, he says that, you know, we can build our own Tic Tacs quickly and it would be in America's interest to do so. You know, Russia's had a head start. That's what he says. I quoted him in the paper. Eric Davis, he's more about, well, you know, we're extrapolating, you know, these technologies for the 38 Defense Intelligence reference documents to the year 2050 to see if our, you know, physics and engineering and, you know, industrial base to support that, you know, will enable us to produce Tic Tac tech and, you know, whether we'll be able to be there and produce craft with these characteristics. So that to me seems to be a much more sort of, you know, into the future extrapolation of possibly where, you know, the United States might be able to reproduce this right. technology. That's just my take.
Well, Jack and his colleague Maurice Passman have also collaborated on what they believe is the Tic Tac's UAP's highly advanced conscious AI. And here are a few of the bullet points included in your paper from Jack and Maurice on this topic. So the first one is that Jack Safrati predicts the Tic Tac is a conscious AI machine. And there are some big words in this one coming up, so maybe you guys can help me out if you know them. The metamaterial fuselage will be found to have a nanoscale quantum dot artificial neural net that is as conscious as we are, if not more so, when externally resonantly pumped into the Frolich macro quantum laser-like phase of active living matter. So he says the quantum dot network emulates our own subneural microtubule network, and the same Frolich resonant pumping is essential for the stealth cloak, low energy, and non-faster-than-light warp drive. And he ends by saying it's a very efficient technology. So I know that you guys have already repeated the fact that you're not 100% sure of some of the things that Jack is saying, because obviously there's just a difference in being able to understand his equations. But can I get you guys to weigh in on these statements or predictions? Do you agree with what Jack is saying in relation to the Tic Tac and a conscious AI?
I would say, from what I've heard, listening to Dr. Jack, and from, you know, that whole episode of the Nimitz, where, you know, the Tic Tac appears at the cap point, kind of like inexplicably, and like, you know, so rapidly. There's even a, you know, I think the Scientific Coalition for Ufology or the other paper, they actually did a calculation of the probability of how fast it would have been able to get there, right, to the cap point. So there's obviously something going on there. But again, not being a scientist, it's hard for me to kind of dissect. And I just say, I mean, you know, people who, you know, some people on Twitter have said, you know, why have you got Jack Safrati? It's like unsubstantiated ideas, not peer reviewed, whatever. Obviously, Eric Dave has got more access to, you know, the research and the technology that, you know, that the US government may or may not have in its possession. He says they do. But even he says, well, you know, we haven't been able to figure it out yet. So I can only go on, you know, what smarter people have said. I think, yes, there is a kind of like a consciousness aspect to it.
So let me say that the statements that are quoted on page 33 of the Advanced Conscious AI in Frank's paper, I agree with that 100%. So the fact that Fravor and his wing person and their two wizzos were told to go back to their combat assembly point, their cap point, and before they ever got their vector pointed in the right direction, the Tic Tac moved and stood perfectly at the point and were warned of that by the radar operators on the USS Princeton, and I've talked to several of them, and all of them agree that happened. That is intelligent control. In other words, the entities were able to interact with our encrypted communication systems or through side channel information, figure out what was being said, and then move to show off for us. That is an active intelligence. It's a goal-seeking behavior. And the goal-seeking behavior, to me, is showing off and saying, see, I can do more than you think I can. Okay, that's number one. I want to point out that Sarfati and Passman talk about quantum dot network able to do artificial intelligence by building a neural network. This to me is not impossible. I don't know the actual technical methods for gluing this together, but I believe that we are moving forward toward building a quantum computing technology, and machine learning and artificial intelligence are going to be the major reasons for moving AI forward into quantum computing. The things I want to point out are massive developments in the field of consciousness. Hoffman has, with his peers out in California, proved that, mathematically speaking, using game theory, and game theory is really well run on quantum computers, by the way, using game theoretic arguments, that any species that actually perceives reality directly with its own biological sensors will fail. And that we do not perceive reality, and the successful organisms that move forward, their sensors are processed by their little computers in their brains in order to maximize they're winning the game of life, not perceiving reality. That's just an unbelievably major achievement. And it's so startling that I don't believe the kind of philosophical physics and neuroscience world has taken Hoffman's arguments up yet and digested them. That's number one. Number two, in my spiel, is John Joe McFadden of the University of Surrey in Guildford has proposed the see me, feel theory, which is a consciousness electromagnetic information field theory. And that, if proven through testable experiments, which it can give us, would explain so much that it is dereliction of duty. If you care about consciousness and how this stuff works, not to study it. So if Sarfati and Passman are right, and consciousness is interacting with the technology on the tic-tac, the see-me feel theory is a complete explanation of how it would work, if it is proven to be right.
Well, it's an interesting point you bring up, because, I mean, if you think about the applications of an AI machine intelligence, obviously, when you're talking about traveling the expanses of space, if they were doing that, they aren't going to be damaged by the vacuum. And obviously, life expectancy is, if not infinite, at least extremely, extremely long. And what I'm wondering is, if the universe is teeming with life, which I'm pretty sure it is, do you think that the most successful forms of intelligent life out there are actually AI machines?
I certainly think that's possible. I don't have a basis for making a credible statement, but I believe we see in our own technological and personal evolution that we are moving towards a conflation of electronic technology and our biology. So the other thing is, I believe that if it were possible for faster than light communications to be attained, that a biological entity would be a fool to take the risk of traveling all the way to Earth if they could have an avatar and it be connected to their consciousness in a way that they were like in augmented reality, wherever they are looking through this cybernetic organism as it's on the Earth. And So again, there is a scientific paper, which I do not believe has gone through peer review, but is available, that says how the faster than light communications might be done. So there's a paper on the Cornell University archive.org called Quantum Ansible, Telegraphed by Cloning a Known Pure State. And they call it Quantum Ansible because it's faster than light communications. So I just think there's lots of stuff going on. Lots of stuff going on that hints that this stuff might be possible. And like Frank is telling you, someone has to say, hey, that's interesting, and we need to fund it.
On page 38, speaking of... Sorry, go on, Frank.
No, I was going to say, totally agree with Bob said. And in terms of, kind of like the artificial intelligence angle, now it's obviously very difficult to assign our understanding to some extraterrestrial intelligence or interdimensional intelligence or wherever it comes from that may be so far in advance of us by thousands of years or centuries. But if you look at what humans do, I mean, before they put themselves in danger, if you're an infantry squad, you're going to put in a small drone into a building or around a building to see what the danger is. If you're an explosive ordnance disposal officer, you're going to send in a robot to try and to recon the device before you go anywhere near it. If you look at the use of drones for reconnaissance and for lethal action in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, you're putting a drone in where you don't have to put an aircraft in and risk the pilot and that platform. So that's just my take.
Now, I want to move on to the British intelligence section of this, because on page 38 of your paper, you have the title A British Intelligence Assessment, which details a declassified British report that was completed in December 2000 by Defence Intelligence 55. Now, DI-55 has been described as a space weapons section responsible for assessing the scientific and technical aspects of UFO reports since 1967. And you go on to say that the report, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena in the UK Air Defence Region, stated that UAP information studies revealed that UFOs, whatever their origin, were of no defence significance, and that information studies do not have any significance towards defence intelligence value. However, the study has uncovered a number of technological issues that may be of potential defence interest. Now, the report continues on to say, the close proximity of plasma-related fields can adversely affect a vehicle or person. Radiated effects are reported, in some very rare instances, to be sufficient to cause scorching of human skin and damage to nearby terrestrial objects. Within the influence of the field, and effectively in its near probable near field discharge path, coupling to vehicle electronic and electrical systems can occur, and it can affect equipment operation. Although this effect has been limited to the temporary malfunction of internal combustion engines and radios within the UK, it is of importance that aircraft equipment could exceptionally be affected for a limited period, according to authoritative open scientific reports from the USA. Now, it seems almost a contradictory statement to first claim there is zero defense interest and to then go on to cite concerns regarding field effects as it relates to human and electric interference. So my question to both of you is, why does the UK have such a different relationship to the UFO subject, at least in comparison to other countries, now including the US? The UK has an extremely closed-door attitude to this. Why do you think that's the case?
I think initially it starts with the kind of traditional British secrecy. I mean, it wasn't until sort of after that the Brits started releasing sort of freedom of information requests like in a big way. Traditionally, pretty much absolutely everything that was official documentation, including how many copies a particular department, how much coffee they were getting through in a week, would probably have been classified. So it boils down to the traditional British preoccupation, I think, with secrecy. I think one of the papers that I referenced with regard to this report, there was a very good article written. It was, I think, a 15-page article written about Condyne. And although the author of Condyne, as I understand it, came from an RAF, a Royal Air Force flying and technical background, I don't think he had access to all the classified RAF reports when he was actually writing this paper. So I think there's a number of flaws in the paper.
I want to support Frank strongly in what he's hinting at and maybe give it a little more emphasis. The English-speaking countries of the world, called the Five Eyes by all of them that work together to do intelligence, are kind of divided into two different groups. One of these groups has an Official Secrets Act, and that's inspired by the others being a member of the British Commonwealth. And the Official Secrets Act is onerous. It really is. I mean, you cross it, you can be snatched up and thrown into prison without a trial. And it's just very, very difficult to leak out secrets or talk about things until official policy allows it. The United States could not be more different. We have national security laws, but we don't have an Official Secrets Act. And we have the Bill of Rights, including freedom of speech, freedom of the press. And Danny Sheehan, who is a well-known lawyer to all the people in the UFO community, is better known amongst the national security and defense people in the United States as that lawyer that broke open the Pentagon Papers and got got all of that defended. So that is now went all the way to the Supreme Court. And so Danny Sheehan made his name, and now he's big into UFOs and Jesuit universities and so forth. But he is well known for utterly destroying the ability of the United States to have an enforceable Official Secrets Act, even though we didn't have one. Richard Nixon tried to impose one and was foiled. And so the Pentagon Papers became known through publication by NBC, New York Times, Washington Post, and others because of the acts of Danny Sheehan. So that action in the past and our laws make us dramatically different from the British Commonwealth, where they have Official Secrets Acts and don't have necessarily a Bill of Rights. What they have is common law that's been maintained since the Magna Carta. Okay, and it's, of course, it's set on precedent and so forth and so on, but it couldn't be more different structurally. And so it's just hard to keep the kind of secrets that, say, the UK keeps inside the United States. Because if Frank comes out and tells the stuff he knows, he can be in jail in an hour.
Do either of you feel that the UAP data is shared securely to Five Eyes Alliance domains, like such as the UK, New Zealand, Australia, from the US via Five Eyes signals, intelligence channels, or anything like that?
We saw recent reports, including in the Tim McMillan article, that is the case.
Well, it's an indication within the Tim McMillan article, but not a definitive, because it's based mainly on the IWS software potentially being a back route into NSA.net. And there's more of a speculation as to whether IWS, I think it's called Information Workspace, is actually still applicable to NSA.net. But I think that was the connection being drawn via Tim's article in regards to Five Eyes data sharing.
Okay, so I will not be commenting on NSA.net.
Yeah, no, I'm not fully... back Bob on that. I think if you sort of wanted to extrapolate this logically, for example, you know, if you're looking, say, just you know, the NATO alliance, anything that's considered an air threat, if some, you know, radar in Spain notices something anomalous and they think that it's a threat, you know, some guy sitting in Northwood in the UK or some American general sitting in a base in Germany or back in the States, everybody's going to have access to that radar picture. I think, you know, you can assume that. And I'm not saying anything classified there. They have an integrated air defense network, NATO, and everybody knows that.
Yeah. Now, you go on in your paper to cover the Soviet involvement with the UFO issue, citing how the Soviet Union and Russian Federation had their own experiences with UFOs, and a situation that was most startling for the Soviets, according to researcher Robert Hastings, who's an expert on the relationship between UFOs and nukes, was the Bielorukovich incident, in which a disc-shaped UFO apparently hovered over a nuclear missile base for an extended period of time. At one point during the encounter, a number of nuclear missiles missiles suddenly activated without authorization from Moscow or any action being taken by the missile launch officers, and they were preparing to launch. Had they done so, as you say in your paper, World War III would have been very likely. But luckily, after 15 seconds, the anomalous activation ceased and the missiles returned to standby status. And a subsequent investigation by the Soviet government discovered that no equipment malfunctions would have explained that event. Now, for me personally, when it comes to the interactions with UFOs and nukes, especially situations such as this, which seem to be quite common during the height of the Cold War, both in the US and the USSR, the very fact that absolutely no launches were fully actioned, coupled with the testimony of certain military personnel who have witnessed ICBMs being disengaged by UFOs during missile tests, it leads me to the conclusion personally that they're not trying to precipitate a world war, but do the exact opposite. I personally think that when they're engaging those missiles, the level of fear in the nuclear silos must have been through the roof. I mean, you know, as these missiles were doing their launch sequence, people would have been praying, people would have been visualizing the nuclear holocaust to come, thinking of their loved ones, and above all else, praying that it stops, praying that the countdown does not complete. And lo and behold, the countdown ends, the launch doesn't occur. And what is left from that? Kind of the most overwhelming sense of relief, you know, the aversion of nuclear fallout, everyone is so relieved. Is there not possibly a lesson in this, you know, that they're trying to impart upon us? I mean, could it not be that they are trying to prove a point? The point being, see, you don't really want to use these things. You think it helps, but actually you're gonna cause so much more damage, and look how relieved you were when it didn't happen. I mean, I would like to get both of your thoughts on this, but this has always been the way I viewed these nuclear incursions, especially the ones that resulted in a false launch scenario. It seems more of a lesson than just messing with us.
Well, I would have to say there's two ways of looking at it. From my perspective, the way that you've looked at it, like, you know, they're trying to teach us a lesson. No, you really don't want to go to nuclear war, you know, and we'd like to sort of like push you in the direction of not going to nuclear war and destroying your planet and destroying yourselves. And you said, you know, there'd be sort of relief after, you know, this countdown had finished. Yes, but probably after that relief, you know, the Russians and, you know, the Russian nuclear officers involved, the Russian nuclear officers involved. Yeah. And on the American side, they'd be asking themselves, well, hang on, you know, this is some advanced civilization. Are they testing, you know, their capabilities on us? Are they, you know, running reconnaissance on our most sensitive sites? Are they testing their ability to basically, you know, deactivate our defenses as a prelude to, you know, further aggressive action against us? So that's the other way of looking at it.
I'm going to tell you, no person who is tasked by the United States government, and it's almost surely the same in all of our allies, will not look at this with a vision of hope, a hopeful message. Their only task is that which has been given to them by the policymakers and the legislatures that are guide the country. And their job is national defense and national security.
Yeah.
The only question they can ask themselves is, are they doing reconnaissance in anticipation of taking action? And what can we do to determine the answer to that question? That is the only responsible approach they themselves can take, and it's understandable. That's their job. They are tasked with that job. We've spent trillions of dollars enabling them to do that job. Now, it's a matter of argument whether or not the money is well spent, and I'm not going to comment on that, but I'm telling you, all the people who are in those silos for the Soviet Union and for the United States, they're going, oh, crap, why are they doing this? And can we do anything other than treat this as an incursion on our national sovereignty and at a time when we are likely in need of these things to defend ourselves against an aggressor, we may not be able to do it. So I just guarantee you that's the thought process that went through all of them.
You know, there are so many theories regarding the occupants of these craft, and in your paper you do address this under the title Non-Human Entities. And as you say in the paper, any ideas on this are based solely on narrow observation of terrestrial science within our current understanding. But I don't know, during your time researching this, both of you, and this is a question that I wonder about myself, and I definitely don't have an answer for. But do you have a speculative gut feeling as to what this phenomenon may be? Who's operating the UFOs?
The truth is, I don't know, but I keep an open mind. If I had to sort of punt, you know, my gut feeling would be there are, you know, physical, biological entities, possibly transdimensional, interdimensional entities. There may be entities that exist just, you know, as pure energy. There may be entities that are, you know, based on a completely different kind of chemical structure to us. The truth is, I don't know. Are they from the future? I don't know, but I keep an open mind towards it, and you know, I certainly want to find out.
I'm with Frank. So as is known, because I've said it publicly, I have had my own experiences, and I can tell you from those experiences that I am baffled, curious, determined to try to find some personal answers and to help others find their answers. But as far as having answers, I don't even have a good guess.
I mean, I've said it before, but especially I think this applies to life, but it also applies to the UFO subject. The more you know, the less you know.
That's true in science. Every time you make an advance in science, it opens up an order of magnitude more questions. I mean, it's just the nature of living.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you mentioned in your paper the difficulties of disclosure from official sources that are operating under national security restrictions, saying how those hiding behind anonymity with nothing to lose who call on TTSA members to go on the record about everything they know, risking jail and a loss of security clearances and effectively ending lifelong careers based around phenomenology, demonstrate wishful thinking about the classified world and those who keep its secrets. Now, not everyone is an Edward Snowden, as you said. With that said, this does chime with a popular theory that TTSA is a disinformation or deception operation on behalf of some nefarious agency and or the gatekeepers of UFO secrecy. Now, with the acknowledgement that TTSA staffers with active NDAs still want to pursue the path of transparency on this issue, how is this best going to be achieved by individuals such as these? Because there are those who call for a revolution, but that's not TTSA. I see TTSA as an initiative that intends to remodel some of the networks and policies within the US government structure so that it best serves the UAP issue. But how do you both feel they can best achieve some level of disclosure whilst also towing the line in regards to respecting their NDAs and not revealing information that they likely do know but can't disclose due to ongoing commitments? How does anyone on the inside best navigate that scenario whilst trying to bring out the truth?
I think it's very difficult for them. As I quoted Mr. Mellon, he wants to, obviously TTSA, they want to move this forward and to have some emission of, you know, more public knowledge available about, you know, the phenomena and the phenomenon in particular, but without compromising sources and methods, you know, platforms and, you know, capabilities, which effectively are not just American security, but also the security of the whole Western alliance. So I think that's very, very difficult, you know, to achieve. But I think the way that they're going, you know, pushing for further transparency and the fact that, yes, we have had, the senators being briefed, that we have had, you know, the staffers being briefed, the fact that there is, you know, a UAP task force has been acknowledged. I mean, one can only hope that there will be, you know, to the furthest extent possible, that there will be more knowledge shared with the public. But as I said previously, you know, I wouldn't hold my breath with that, because, you know, these agencies that are tasked with, collating and assessing the information on UAP, the data from all these different sensors, they're going to be very, very loath, to give up any of it. That's just my take.
I want to support what Frank says, and say that the people in TTSA outside of DeLong have a conflict of interest. Yeah. They want to maintain their clearances and at the same time be transparent. So the one thing we can do is judge them on their behavior. And what do we know of their behavior? I think it's apparent that they are largely responsible for the entire conversation exploding into a completely different direction, leading to these Senate hearings and leading to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence adding UFO language, UAP language to the NDAA. They are responsible for that. So they are to be credited with that. They've also done a lot of outreach. The outreach is not to UFO Twitter. The outreach is to the general public. They've gone on television shows, news shows. They've briefed congresspeople, arranged for congresspeople to hear from military and government witnesses. Their actions speak louder than our guesses. So their actions show they're trying to get stuff done. And, you know, we want to support them in that to the extent that they're also at the same time trying to set up a business where contract dollars from the federal government will flow to TTSA to sustain their efforts. That will be an impediment because there will be, especially if they begin doing applied work for the DOD or the intelligence community, that work will be classified. And so what was a conduit of information can overnight end with a signature on a security description document and it accompanying a contract. So it's a tension. It's a constant tension with them. They have these goals, and I think their goals, they have multiple goals. Some of them are going to open up and be transparent about things that are going on, and others are going to be trying to get work and do interesting work in an area that clearly obsesses them.
Okay, so we're undoubtedly in some form of next generation arms race with Russia and China, and this probably does extend to the exotic capabilities observed by UAP. As you mentioned in your paper, there are serious concerns regarding China's technological and militaristic goals for the next few decades, which, as you also say, makes the 38 defense intelligence reference documents that extrapolate engineering and physics to 2050, the ones that we've heard about from ATIP, it makes them seem a lot more sensible when you correlate this to concerns about China's ambitions. So I'll put this to both of you. Could the concerns of technological and militaristic supremacy between the US, Russia, and China end up being the catalyst for the development of technology and platforms that match the capabilities of the Tic Tac?
I say yes.
I'd say yes as well, especially if you look at, you know, the DIRDs, to me, the sort of the defense intelligence reference documents, to me, that demonstrates intent to reach that. If you look at, you know, China with their, you know, their development, whether it's hypersonic missiles, whether it's quantum technology, their desire to completely supplant, you know, the Americans and the Western alliance system in economic terms, in military terms, and to basically become, you know, the preeminent state, the preeminent global power themselves. I think it very much makes sense. I think the important thing to bear in mind was the point made by, that's been repeatedly made to me by, you know, Colonel Alexander, which is, you know, there's lots of things that you want to fund, but you run out of money a long time before you can fund
right.
them all.
Right.
So that's the big problem. But, and I think, you know, problem with, you know, especially with the Americans is, you know, because they've been involved in, you know, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for so long, and now they've got to deal with, you know, sort of they've allowed certain aspects of their capabilities to kind of decline relative to near peer adversaries like Russia and China. And Russia and China have taken advantage of this. So there's going to be a competition between, you know, trying to, you know, fund a huge Manhattan style project to develop Tic Tac tech. And this is just my humble opinion. There's going to be a huge, you know, there's going to be a trade-off between that and, you know, continuing to maintain sort of more traditional capabilities. I don't know. What do you think about that, Bob?
I completely agree. But look, the United States is willing to do deficit spending, and because we have for decades. And we are going into a period where our deficit spending is going to get even worse, dealing with COVID, the downturn in the economy,
the utter contempt and neglect for bipartisan work so that we can rebuild our infrastructure, and the constant need to maintain our military, whether people like it or not. We do have adversaries, and they test us constantly. I still do not understand why the U.S. military and the intelligence community does not make public some modicum of the times our adversaries test us to see whether or not we're awake. And that constant probing says to us, we need our military because they're trying to find a weakness. Okay, so given all of that, everyone is going to look at any new entity coming forward and trying to grab a pot of money, no matter how laudable or lofty the goals. They're going to view them as competition, and it's going to turn into a bureaucratic fight. I'm just telling you, that's the way government works.
Now, you finish this paper off with the title UFOs and Demons, highlighting the concern regarding internal beliefs within the U.S. government, Department of Defense, and other agencies regarding the origin of UFOs and the occupants within, because there have been statements provided by people such as Luis Elizondo that highlight the fact that high-ranking officials within the Department of Defense are refusing to look into the UAP issue due to their own religious beliefs, attributing UAPs and their occupants to a demonic or satanic presence, and one that not only does not merit scientific investigation, but should quite literally be ignored completely as the work of the devil. Now, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence Christopher Mellon was quoted in your paper to say, "It would be tragic and ironic if we found out that some of these things were Russian or Chinese and we hadn't been investigating because someone thought they were demons." That's just not an appropriate mindset in this context. And then Colonel Alexander also told you, "I would hope that additional information being released about sightings from USG organizations understand that there are legitimate security concerns regarding the operational parameters of the sensor systems or the platforms. Unfortunately, I suspect a lot has to do with embarrassment as not being able to explain the observations. That is further complicated by, of course, religious opinions. Both are real problems. So my question to you both is, how do you tackle an issue like this when religious beliefs are actually preventing meaningful study of an issue that not only represents, from a government perspective, a national security threat, but for the entire human species, it represents potential answers to some of the most fundamental questions that have plagued us since the dawn of time? How do we tackle this issue? Because it is one that needs to be addressed when you're talking about structures of belief systems that are preventing study that exist within the structure of the US government and probably other governments as well.
Well, first of all, I think, you know, that those statements, they're very interesting because, you know, that's coming from within, you know, these people who've been insiders, are saying that, you know, that there are these, sometimes you get these prevailing attitudes within, you know, parts of the US intelligence community. I'm not sure how widespread, but, you know, these guys are saying it. I think that's so interesting because if you look at, you know, the non-classified world, what have we had? You know, you've had the cover-up, you've had the twin pillars of the cover-up, which is, you know, the denial and the ridicule. And then this is like another pillar to that, which is, you know, the refusal to believe, the kind of cognitive dissonance. It doesn't fit in with what you believe, what you were brought up with, you know, your upbringing. So you deny it, you know, out of hand. I think the solution is you need to have people who don't have that kind of baggage, people who are open-minded, who are the ones who need to be looking at this, at the phenomena in general.
Okay, I just think we're going to have to wait them out. I believe what's going on is the most conservative mindsets are held by people who've been around for a long time, and they're slowly retiring and leaving government. Let me give you an example that's public. The United States government was basically afraid of changing its ITAR rules surrounding satellites and their development and rocketry and their development, because Senator John Kyle of Arizona was feared, because he was such a fierce opponent of anything being developed along these lines being spoke of, to the point where it was a prior restraint on your First Amendment rights to speak of satellites and rockets. And so just imagine that now changed to something that interacts with us using technologies we don't understand, with motives we don't understand, and look like little gnomes. I mean, you can just imagine where that kind of mindset would go. And to the extent that as you gain more information and as it goes on for a longer time with no aggressive action being taken against us by the phenomenon, then it's likely to break down this need for secrecy because of the desire to be transparent in a government that's supposed to be the servants of its people. In the United States, I think time will erode their ability to keep all this secret. And we've already seen this with the advent of TTSA and the exposure of Nimitz, Roosevelt, and ATIP and OSAP.
I'd like to add to that, guys. I think they need to get a shift on and do it quickly as well. And, you know, root out these people who are kind of exhibiting this kind of extreme cognitive dissonance. Because obviously that's a real impediment to both national security and the wider aspects of improving mankind, the possibilities for knowledge, for interaction with NHEs, which Chris Mellon actually hinted at as well, and which I quoted in the paper. And I think they need to get a shift on, especially for the national security aspects, because the Russians, the 70s, there are all those reports on, Russian parapsychology and their research. I mean, the Russians don't have any cognitive dissonance when it comes to this topic.
Gentlemen, it has been an absolute pleasure having this conversation. And I just want to thank both of you for being here. And Frank, I want to once again congratulate you for putting this absolutely extraordinary paper together, which can be viewed on the Basis Center website. A link for everyone listening will be in the description box below. And I would highly encourage everyone to go ahead and read this paper in its entirety, as it's an extremely worthwhile read. In fact, it received praise from Christopher Mellon, who said on Twitter, and I quote, "Frank Milburn of the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies recently published this extraordinarily insightful assessment of the USG's new UAP investigation. He's done a thorough job reviewing the open source literature and is asking the right questions." So thank you again. And is there anything either of you want to say before we wrap this up?
Just let me say it was a pleasure being on with both of you.
Yeah, I was going to say pretty the same thing. Bob, thank you very much. Jay, thank you very much as well. It's been a really fascinating conversation for me and a fascinating time, being on and speaking with both of you.